fair. That's fine. Then you have 10. Bring in the next 100, and you'll have a jury.
Okay. They're all, though, from Manhattan. Now, Trump says he can't get a fair trial here in his home city. Talk about that.
Number one, he doesn't want a fair trial. No defendant wants a fair trial. Every defendant wants a jury that's predisposed to acquit them. That's just sort of baked into the whole process. He certainly can get a fair trial in the sense that you get rid of all the jurors who have strong feelings one way or the other about his guilt or his innocence. Remember, this is not a referendum on Trump as president, which would be, I think, a harder case in Manhattan. It doesn't matter whether you liked his presidency or, like most Manhattanites, loathed it. These actions, the activities accused of engaging in, they took place before he became president. The crime was committed before he became president of the United States. So it doesn't involve great questions of presidential power and authority. It's just regular old garden variety fraud, with a porn star or a sex worker added in to add some spice to it, and, of course, Attorney Michael Cohen.
So let's talk about what exactly he's being charged with. I mean, if you were giving hush money to someone, that would not be a crime.
Totally legal.
Of course, Trump is going simply to argue he just didn't want to hurt his family, so he wanted this person to remain quiet about their affair. But this has to do with the election. Explain that.
One of the crimes, the underlying crimes that the hush money was designed to conceal was federal election finance law. That Michael Cohen was basically making an expenditure. This was a campaign expenditure, and Trump covered it up because he didn't want the American people to know that he was paying off a porn star just prior to the election. And the timing of that payment is significant, having taken place just before the election. Michael Cohen is going to testify what it was for. There's going to be conversations that Trump had with other people that make reference to Stormy Daniels and the election. And I don't know that Trump is going to be arguing anything, because Trump would have to testify to make that argument.
And, of course, he says he will.
Of course
he will. But he has said that even in the civil cases. Oh,
he always says he's going to do this or he has done that. And maybe when the time the trial is over, he will have said he testified, even though he didn't. But it's unlikely, frankly, from a criminal defense perspective, it's unlikely that he's going to get on that witness stand.
We're not going to see any of this.
No. There was a brief period of time, a couple of years in the 1990s, where we had cameras in the New York State courtrooms. Most people thought it was a fantastic success, and it helped legitimize the system. Most famously, the Amadou Diallo trial, for those who remember, was televised live. Everybody could see what happened. The powers that be decided that should not be renewed, except for pretrial performances, as it were. So we're not going to see the trial.
Can someone convicted of a felony become president?
Absolutely. There's no bar to becoming president of the United States if you're convicted of a felon. However, you cannot own a firearm. So at least if he gets elected, he won't be able to have a gun. He'll have the United States military, but not a gun.
And you have to be born in the United States.
Yes.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Ron Kuby, longtime criminal defense and civil rights lawyer here in New York. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our digital fellowship. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nandura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randall, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, and Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
WRCT, the In Sound from Way Out.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we explore how anti-pornography laws in many states can theoretically be used to prosecute teenagers.
New York City Attorney Andrew Stengel joins us to explain how courts approach the sharing of intimate photos among adolescents.
We'll also take a look at multinational corporations' roles in social responsibility, including international acts of genocide.
Simon Billinus shares his expertise on this field as well as his work with the coalition called No Business with Genocide.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
Because teenagers spend a good deal of their time online and on social media platforms, awareness has risen about related risks, such as cyberbullying, shaming, and online predation. But then there's sexting, the sharing between teenagers of explicit images. A study in the Journal of the American Medical Association revealed that sexting is common among adolescents, with at least one in four teens receiving explicit texts and emails. What we don't hear much about are the legal consequences of such communications. In half of the states in this country, criminal laws classify the act of sexting among minors as a felony. New York, California, New Jersey, and Michigan are among those states. Their laws consider the exchange, possession, distribution, or production of explicit images of minors through sexting as felony offenses under certain circumstances. The specific criteria and the penalties vary, obviously, from state to state. Teenagers who engage in sexting rarely realize the consequences of their actions. Since teens are minors, sharing nude or explicit or suggestive photos of themselves or their friends is considered child pornography. That means that possessing or sending the photos may amount to criminal possession or distribution of child pornography. And if convicted for one of these offenses, young people theoretically may face severe penalties and lifelong consequences. Joining us today is New York City criminal defense attorney Andrew Stengel. Andrew is a former prosecutor in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office who has also worked in the executive and legislative branches of New York State government, and he's also worked at the Brennan Center for Justice. Andrew, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for having me.
Andrew, before we get into the legal aspects of sexting and teenagers, how do you define sexting?
You know, I'm reminded of the Supreme Court decision on pornography that said, you know it when you see it. I can't define it, but I know it when you see it. Usually it's used in the context of an explicit image, nudity, or sex act that's unwanted. You know, there is such thing as consensual sexting. People who are in a romantic relationship send each other images, and that's consensual. The more usual connotation, and I think what we're talking about today, is when it's non-consensual.
And we've covered the issue of revenge porn in the past. How is sexting related to revenge porn in terms of how acts of revenge are prosecuted, for example?
Well, sexting and revenge porn are sort of cousins, although sexting can be legal, as we talked about, because it could be between two consenting adults. Revenge porn is not legal. Revenge porn in many states and in New York is both a crime and a civil cause of action. It's the unlawful dissemination and or publication of intimate images, otherwise known as non-consensual pornography. Even if the images, whether it's photographs or video, were taken with the consent of a participant, The issue is that they're promulgated without a party's consent, hence the term revenge porn.
You know, Andrew, a few years ago on Law and Disorder, we actually interviewed Carrie Goldberg, who was a victim herself of revenge porn and then fought. I guess she actually changed her law practice to represent individuals who have been targeted by revenge porn. Are selfies considered pornography if they're taken by minors on their own volition? This kind of relates to what you just said about consent.
Well, if you mean pornography in the sense that it's illegal, yes, it could be. So if a minor were to take an image of themselves and send it to somebody, that is, while not revenge porn, that is an illegal act. Sending, it could be a federal crime. It could be pornography as well, as a state crime. So that is illegal as well.
Can you talk a little bit more about the distinction between sexting on the one hand and flirting or communicating as part of a romantic relationship on the other?
Sure. So, you know, in this day and age with technology, the access to a camera and video camera in everybody's phone, many times people either take recordings of themselves, images of themselves, or images and or recordings of with other people. And there's nothing wrong with that, especially if it's two consenting adults. That's great. We live in a sex-positive, or what should be a sex-positive society. Where it goes off the rails or when people have use it for a bad purpose, those images to exact revenge on a partner by uploading them to Reddit, uploading them to Pornhub, sending it in group chats without the consent of the other party. And that's where revenge porn comes into play.
Andrew, we've jumped ahead a bit. I think if you could explain how teenagers are being, in several states in this country, brought up on charges, often felonies, for sexting, and what kind of penalties they may face if they're found guilty. And also, to make this a really compound question, do courts have discretion in sentencing, be it in juvenile or in adult criminal court?
So in New York, juveniles, youths, are prosecuted in family courts rather than criminal courts, at least in New York. And family courts take the approach of problem solving. You know, the idea in some criminal courts is punishment and rehabilitation. That's not what happens in family court where juveniles are dealt with and or adjudicated. The purpose of family courts is to rehabilitate or act as sort of a social worker. It's not to punish a youth. Now, of course, there are certain crimes that where punishment is a factor, even when you have a juvenile offender, and that juvenile offender could be tried as an adult for some crimes in regular criminal court. But in New York and family courts, they take a problem-solving approach. A few different times, there are sort of relief valves for people who are brought to family court who could be arrested or who are arrested for revenge porn, teen sexting, even unlawful surveillance, which is a related crime to revenge porn. That's the non-consensual recording of somebody when they're nude. Family courts, through the Department of Probation, first assess the juvenile, and they may do something even before it gets to the prosecutor, which is usually the city. In New York's case, it's Corporation Council. They may adjust. They may do something called an adjustment, which means that person never faces prosecution. They're dealt with a social worker, and that's the end of the case. Even if the Department of Probation, in New York City, decides not to adjust a juvenile offender, the Office of Corporation Council assesses the case, and they could order adjustment. And even if they don't order adjustment, once it gets before a judge in family court, that judge in family court is really unlikely to punish the person. The juvenile offender is going to be educated, and the goal will be not to punish them, but to educate them, him or her, on why what they've done is wrong and try to prevent that from happening in the future.
And aside from going through that criminal legal system, what are some of the other consequences to kids and teenagers of sexting?
Well, there are a lot of consequences. The public schools, private schools, have their own rules and regulations, and people could be suspended from school. People could be expelled from school. You know, that's obviously extrajudicial. But schools have a lot of power to police this type of behavior in the anti-bullying laws throughout the country and in New York State.
Andrew, you're a former prosecutor, so you probably know that a few years ago, William Fitzpatrick, as president of the National District Attorneys Association, urged prosecutors to approach teenage sexting with a light hand, you know, for the reasons you've just discussed in family court. He suggested seeking less severe and lasting punishments instead of criminal charges in many cases. Can you talk about national trends on this issue?
Sure. Well, as a matter of fact, I believe that district attorney was the district attorney of Onondaga County. And this morning I was in Syracuse, New York at 9 a.m., but now I'm back home. Yes, there is a national trend because the availability of cell phones, pornography, social media applications are so widespread and so tempting. The trend nationally is to educate youth rather than punish them. It doesn't make sense. I mean, you would never throw a 14-year-old, 15-year-old in jail for teen sexting. There's no point in that. You wouldn't want to saddle that person with a criminal record for the rest of their life. The goal in those cases should be education and prevention, and that is the national trend in New York and other states.
And how up-to-date on technology are the judges and prosecutors about how technology is used in real life? And if they're not completely up-to-date, how does that impact how they're enforcing the laws? And for that matter, what about legislators?
That's an excellent question. So I've been on trial before for a revenge porn case. As a matter of fact, I'm in the middle of a trial on two related revenge porn cases. And there are judges from time to time that really don't understand how social media works, how posting an image on social media works, how Snapchat works. So the court system should do a better job in educating judges about social media. The burden is on the plaintiff's attorney to educate the finder of fact. But if the person who is the minder of the law doesn't really understand social media and you're prosecuting a claim for revenge porn, that could be a problem. And I've seen it happen before.
Andrew, obviously, keeping confidentiality, are you able to tell us about a case or two that you've represented either with a teenager and sexting or with an incident of revenge porn and how that's gone?
I'd rather not, just because of the privacy of the parties, but I can speak generally. I have represented individuals or parents, I should say, on behalf of their kids who have both been victims of revenge porn and been perpetrators of revenge porn. And a lot of times the issues are solved between the two sets of parents where they work something out together. One of the main issues is that when a person takes a photograph or a video, the person who takes a photograph or video owns the copyright. And sometimes if the perpetrator owns the copyright, you really want to transfer that copyright to the victim so they can enforce it in the future. Now, no reputable website is going to allow child pornography on it. However, it's always helpful to assert a claim and ask for a takedown under the DMCA as the copyright holder. Now, of course, under the DMCA, any website is going to remove child pornography as well, but there are sometimes complicated legal issues involved with teen sexting beyond whether or not we make a report to the police.
That's fascinating. I have a question just to clarify. Is child pornography, does that impact children under the age of 18 in New York State, for example?
Yes, it does. I mean, the age of consent is 17 in New York. Under federal law, it's higher, but 17 in New York. So you could have conflicting laws. Very rarely, I will say very rarely, I don't think the FBI is prosecuting cases of child pornography when there are teens in school doing things. Look, it's very harmful to the victim, but I think the FBI probably views it as misbehaving. So I don't think they're getting involved with peer-to-peer teen sexting issues. It's more of a state issue.
And Andrew, what are the types of legal defenses that are brought in these civil cases and criminal cases for that matter?
It's hard because sort of, you know, the images tell the entire story. So if an intimate image of a person has been disseminated, posted, texted, it's hard to defend a case like that. You really have to look towards mitigation. What am I doing to stop it from happening? I may have promulgated it. I know it was wrong. Let's make the situation better. You know, a person who commits an act of revenge porn, and if the victim has evidence of that, the perpetrator is sort of screwed, and for good reason.
I know you said that a lot of these cases are settled or dealt with an educational prevention component, but in cases that have gone to court, do juries hear these cases? And if so, do they tend to be sympathetic toward young people?
Very rarely do teenage revenge porn or sexting cases go to trial in civil cases because, you know, for a civil attorney, at least in New York, you're working on a contingency fee. No attorney is going to get a recovery from a teenager. So there's nothing to recover. I mean, you can't take blood from a stone. So if a person doesn't have any money, whether an adult or child, there's probably not an incentive to sue. You can win $1 million, but if the person's worth $10, what's the point? There really isn't a point. So that question really more applies to adults. And yes, juries are really sympathetic to victims of revenge porn. There have been studies that show that the effects, the trauma of revenge porn is akin, though not the same, as a sexual assault. There is a doctor in Florida named Dr. Asia Eaton, who is a university professor, who's written about this. And that's what her studies find.
And Andrew, are you aware of any adolescents in New York State, or elsewhere for that matter, who have been incarcerated for sexting?
I'm not. And frankly, it wouldn't serve a purpose to incarcerate an adolescent for sexting. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, it just from a social justice point of view, and even as a former prosecutor, now a complex personal injury lawyer, it wouldn't make sense. I mean, in a case like that, you'd want to educate the person and prevent it from happening again. That's not what prisons should be used for.
Andrew, what do you advise parents, speaking of education, and school teachers for that matter, to do in terms of informing kids about not only the fact that in some states sexting is against the law, but mostly about the long-term, long-lasting repercussions of having images put up on the web, for example?
Well, I think that conversation starts with respecting other people. Forget what's illegal and what's legal for a second. Respecting other people. That you have to respect other people's privacies and have to have boundaries. And if you don't, the consequences are severe. And again, set aside the criminal and civil penalties. You know, if something is released on the internet or something is texted to somebody else, an intimate image, a photo or video, it's never coming back. It may last forever. So those consequences are severe. And again, I'm not talking about civil or criminal. I'm talking about the consequences to the victim. And people really have to think about their actions and have to be educated that teen sexting, that revenge pornography, and I'm talking about juveniles, I'm talking about youth, not adults, can have severe consequences. And it's the ultimate act of disrespect, short of a sexual assault, of course. And it's never coming back. That's where the conversation should start. You know, I don't think you're going to dissuade a child, a young man, a woman from committing an act of revenge porn and teen sexting, explaining the civil penalties and possible criminal penalties. I don't think that approach would work.
And what about the schools and school districts? They do have responsibility, they have duties. Should they be doing more to protect students? And if so, what else can be done?
Most states, like New York, have anti-bullying legislation, have gender discrimination legislation, and schools take a very firm approach when they learn about issues about teen sexting. Now, I'm not talking about revenge porn. I'm just talking about teen sexting, the so-called consensual, because a young man or a woman, 13, 14, 15, can't consent or shouldn't be consenting to a nude image. But they take a really ironclad approach, an aggressive approach, when they learn about teen sexting. And I've represented clients who are both victims and accused of teen sexting in school. And the actions of the school are often swift. Although I will tell you that there are other cases that I'm involved with where the school isn't sensitive enough to the victim of teen sexting and just assumes that they were a willing participant, which may not always be the case.
You know, you reminding me of some of the cases we're hearing about where, I think it's one or two cases, where parents of school shooters are now being held accountable for their kids' actions. I just wonder, would it be too far-fetched to think that if a school didn't take actions like these seriously, that they could be drawn into a lawsuit as liable?
I think holding a parent responsible for their minor child's act of teen sexting or revenge porn is a bridge too far. You learn in law school that a parent is really only liable when they give their child a dangerous instrument. And I think I remember, you know, centuries ago, the example being a chainsaw.
Right.
You know, and a gun is all, I mean, you shouldn't give access, you shouldn't let a child have access to a firearm either. But I don't think that as harmful as teen sexting and revenge porn is, it will be seen as a dangerous instrument the same way as a chainsaw, motorcycle, or firearm are.
Andrew Stengel, what about, to make matters even more complicated, what about artificial intelligence? How is AI playing into all of this?
So New York is a leader in this area, actually. The legal name in New York for revenge porn is unlawful dissemination or publication of an intimate image. A few years ago, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, New York added to its definition a computer-generated image. So it is illegal in New York to create a deep fake porn of a person without their consent. And it's actionable as a civil lawsuit.
Andrew, how can our listeners follow your work?
My website, www.stengellaw.com, has a lot of information about revenge porn, tools for victims of revenge porn, parents of teenagers who are victims of revenge porn. You know, one of the most important things to do is take records, take screenshots, write down URLs where the revenge porn exists. If it's online, if it's through an app, try to take screenshots of where the revenge porn or teen sexting occurred, because you may need that in the future.
That's great advice. And I would also add, I imagine a lot of teenagers might be extremely embarrassed when they learn, for example, that a private image has been shared publicly. So you probably see this a lot in families. I think it's good advice for kids to tell any trusted adult. If they're too embarrassed to go to their parents or teachers, they need to confide in someone they trust so that they're not suffering alone and so that this doesn't potentially worsen.
In my experience, and look, I don't know what I don't know, the famous tautology, the victims of revenge porn do speak to their parents, or their parents notice a change in behavior and speak to their child. And that's really how it comes up. Or a friend protecting the victim of revenge porn tells a parent, and then it becomes a telephone tree. That parent calls the victim's parent. So it really often comes out.
Well, that's good to know. Kids, if you're listening, be on the lookout for your friend's welfare. Andrew Stengel, yes, thank you so much, both for your important work and for joining us here on Law and Disorder.
You're welcome, and thank you for your interest.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
April is Earth Month, a time to think more deeply about our relationship with and responsibility to our planet and the ecosystem we rely on, and of course, our fellow living beings. With technology and social media, we have unprecedented access to information and images from all over the world. But witnessing those natural disasters, wars, and other untold suffering, well, that can also be overwhelming. Thankfully, there are people like today's guest to remind us that we, individually and collectively, have so much power to change the course of history and create a healthier world for future generations. Our guest is Simon Billinas, an advocate for environmental sustainability, human rights, corporate governance, and social justice. Described by the New York Times as a super specialist in human rights advocacy, Simon has, for more than two decades, advised investors, nonprofits, universities, communities, and unions in holding corporations accountable. Simon is currently the executive director of the International Campaign for the Rohingya and for the coalition-led campaign No Business with Genocide. He also serves on the Business and Human Rights co-group of Amnesty International USA. Simon Billinas, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Can you start us off by sharing some of the methods you and other activists use to effect change on an international scale?
Well, you know, I always like to start with working with people where they are. Whenever I'm talking to people who want to make a difference on an issue, any issue, I always emphasize to them that they have a lot of power already. They have power as citizens to participate in the political process. They have power as consumers. They also have power as investors, and particularly the consumer power and the shareholder power. Those are sort of key tools that people can use to hold companies accountable on issues of human rights or social justice or sustainability.
Simon, please tell us about your work as a member of Amnesty International USA's Business and Human Rights co-group. What does the group do, and what are some of its priorities?
We are a group of people with a lot of expertise in corporate accountability issues. We're what's called member leaders. We're not staff of Amnesty International. We are members and volunteers who spend some of our time working with the staff at Amnesty International to develop and implement Amnesty's campaigns around corporate accountability. One of the things we're working on right now is with regard to Dow Chemical on the 40th anniversary of the Bhopal chemical disaster in India. We're working to put more pressure on Dow Chemical to properly still, clean up this 40-year-old site, and also to provide adequate compensation to all the people who have suffered decades of disease and death because of the chemical disaster. And as part of that, we've been, again, working with our Amnesty colleagues, both staff and members all around the world, to put pressure on Dow Chemical's biggest shareholders to, in turn, put pressure on the company to properly do right by the community in Bhopal, India.
Simon, there was a documentary that came out in 2003 called The Corporation. The premise of the film is that if a corporation is legally a person, like the Supreme Court says it is, well, then their behavior is often like a dangerously destructive psychopath with no conscience, pursuing quick profits above all else. Do you agree with that characterization, or do you think it's possible to run a corporation in a way that's beneficial for society? And if it is possible, why haven't more corporations followed suit?
I highly recommend both the film, The Corporation, and the accompanying book. I was actually interviewed for that movie, but I guess my clip did not make its way into the film. I guess it got left on the cutting room floor, which was a shame. But I think the key thing to realize with both corporations and also governments, for that matter, is that corporations and governments are not moral entities. This is what differentiates them from real people like us. And even though corporations have, particularly in the U.S., attained some degree of legal personhood, they're not people. They don't have a conscience. They've been chartered and set up for the most part to deliver the best possible returns to their shareholders. And that is what the vast majority of corporations do. And this is why, I spend so much time and do so much work holding companies accountable and, again, using the tools that we have in the marketplace, our consumer pressure and our shareholder pressure, and working in conjunction with campaigns to hold companies legally accountable and to regulate those companies by governments. So a corporation is never going to have a conscience, but a corporation can do the right thing if enough pressure is put on them to do so. And that's what I do.
Simon, there was a sequel to The Corporation a few years ago. And I was also interviewed for that and ended up mostly on the cutting room floor along with you. Can you tell us more about the concept of shareholder activism? What is it? And is it really effective?
Yeah, shareholder activism is where I first sort of came into the work of corporate accountability over 30 years ago. As I was doing my MBA at Boston College, a college that I chose for my MBA because I thought it had the best grounding in ethics of any MBA program in the Boston area. I was also working part-time and later full-time once I graduated with Trillium Asset Management, which is a socially responsible investment firm. And what I developed there was like a new body of work around shareholder activism that focused on human rights. I did a report called Thinking Globally, where we looked at, what were the what were going to be the key new issues for shareholders around human rights now that the at the time, the campaign against apartheid in South Africa was, you know, reaching its conclusion. And I identified, you know, three issues that I thought would be very big moving forward. One was the whole issue of sweatshops and labor rights abuses in companies' supply chains. I also identified two countries that were problematic for companies to operate in, Burma, also known as Myanmar, and also China. And that's kind of where I started. And, you know, I've seen a lot of value to corporate accountability campaigns that comes from organizing shareholders in a company to put pressure on that company. I've seen it it move companies. I've seen it be very effective as part of sort of larger campaigns to highlight an issue, get it in the news. And I have to tell you, you know, now I'm, you know, working in Washington, D.C. for International Campaign for the Rohingya, and we're putting a lot of pressure on Chevron to stop funding the Myanmar military junta. When we're talking with members of Congress, when we're talking with the State Department, the fact that there's a group of shareholders in Chevron who are also putting pressure on Chevron not to keep funneling money to the Myanmar military. The fact that Chevron is facing opposition from its own shareholders, that makes it much harder for Chevron in turn here in Washington, D.C., to lobby against the kind of sanctions that we're seeking that would stop Chevron from doing that.
That's so interesting. And speaking of sanctions, in 2022, the U.S. and many other countries and global corporations stopped doing business with Russia after it invaded Ukraine. And then, of course, on the other hand, boycotts and sanctions against Israel for invading Gaza is a far more controversial matter in the U.S. anyway. So in your experience, are sanctions and boycotts effective? And if so, are there ways to limit the harm to the innocent people who are out there on the ground and maybe suffering consequences?
It's two very, very good questions. And, you know, as I was saying earlier, you know, I came into doing corporate accountability work in the wake of the successful campaign, the successful international campaign against the apartheid regime in South Africa. You know, in the case of South Africa, you know, we were all able to develop an impressive array of tools to put pressure on the apartheid regime in South Africa. And, you know, for the past 30 years or so, I've been using that same toolbox, but applying it to different countries and different situations because these tools work. And I'm talking about consumer boycotts, I'm talking about shareholder pressure, and I'm talking about sanctions by governments. Now, what was key about the campaign against apartheid in South Africa was that this call for sanctions on South Africa and on the apartheid regime, this was coming from, you know, representatives of the majority of the people inside South Africa. So it wasn't sanctions that were being imposed on a country from outside so much as it was an act of solidarity with the democracy movement, with the resistance movement inside South Africa, who were calling for these tactics and were saying that this was an effective tool for people in the international community to aid them in their struggle against the apartheid regime. And I think that's how you make sure that you're not harming innocent people, or more importantly, you're deferring to the people of that country as to how they want to make those trade-offs and what strategy they would like to see from the international community. In the case of Burma right now, particularly since the February 1st, 2021 military coup, we've been focused on what we call targeted sanctions against the Myanmar military and its business interests. There isn't a call inside Burma for broad sanctions, but there is a call for sanctions that hit the Myanmar military and go after its sources of revenues, its sources of arms, and its sources of aviation fuel, which they need for the airstrikes that they conduct on civilians. And so I think that's how you get around the question and the concern, which is a very valid concern, as to, well, you know, do these sanctions, do these campaigns against companies, are they hurting the people or not? You know, I think part of it is making sure that you're working in collaboration and in solidarity with the people you're trying to help, and you're listening to what they're asking for in terms of their help and what they're asking for in terms of strategy.
That's so important. You know, Simon, Maria and I come from a background of, I guess it's cause lawyering, where through the National Lawyers Guild and attorneys, member attorneys of that organization, it's really important to listen to the people in the movements you're representing and take your cues from them. Now, you direct an organization, or rather a coalition, called No Business with Genocide. Tell us about its mission, the coalition members, and its campaigns.
Certainly. We're built on the assumption that governments around the world need foreign investment. They need foreign trade. They rely on it. What we're working to do is to put pressure on companies not to be complicit in genocide or other mass atrocities, and also not to support governments engaged in genocide or other mass atrocities. And the goal is to create enough collective pressure on key companies that governments around the world understand that if they cross certain lines and if they commit certain crimes against humanity, you know, leading up to genocide, they understand that if they cross that line, they will lose the foreign investment, the foreign trade that they need to stay in power. And so we're sort of starting to create, want to create sort of tripwires as an effective deterrent against genocide and other mass atrocities. So we sort of developed this campaign around working to end the genocide of the Rohingya in Burma. And more recently, we've started doing work in support of the Uyghurs in China. And also, we've been doing work around Sudan, and now more recently, Armenia. In all of these situations, we're organizing both grass tops and grassroots lobbying of Congress and the administration. We're also, you know, lending our support to lobbying of governments outside the U.S., like in the U.K., European Union, Canada. But we're focused on researching what are the companies in each of these cases that are providing the support to these regimes as they carry out these atrocities. And what can we do to put pressure on those companies, in turn to put pressure on those governments to get them to pull back? So that's what we do right now, and it is like focused in those two areas. One is, again, on the sanction side and the support for people in these countries in these situations, and the other is putting market-based economic pressure on companies, consumer pressure, shareholder pressure, media, particularly social media pressure, on companies to get them to make sure that they're not complicit in genocide and they're also not supporting genocidal regimes.
Well, as a reminder to listeners, this is Law and Disorder. I'm Maria Hall, and I'm here with my co-host, Heidi Boghossian, and we're speaking with human rights specialist Simon Bilenis. Simon, why do you think the mainstream media in the West hasn't reported more on critical stories concerning ethnic cleansing and genocide and these other very critical issues? And what stories do you think are more worthy of amplifying, such as the four areas you just mentioned? And please tell us about those basic issues. You mentioned Armenia and the Uyghurs. Please give us a little more background on those.
Yeah, I mean, I think perhaps a little bit more generally. I mean, I think that what we've seen, you know, in each of these countries, whether it's Burma, whether it's the case of the Uyghurs in China, Sudan right now is in the news. Armenia, you know, was more in the news a few months ago and has dropped out a little bit. But what we tend to find is that about 10% of the time, these countries are in the news. And that's when we are able to reach out more broadly to people. You know, as people are reading about what's going on in say, Burma, and they want to do something about it, we're able to reach out to them with a clear message of, this is what you can do right now about Burma, about the Uyghurs, about these issues that you care about. And that's why we have online actions for people to lobby their members of Congress, for people in the U.S. That's why we have petitions to specific companies that people anywhere in the world can sign on to. And the way we organize is that when these countries are in the news, that is when we see, you know, so many people taking our actions, so many people being added to our email list from signing these petitions and taking online actions to lobby their members of Congress. And that builds up our capacity, builds up our movement to continue to take that action when these countries are not in the news. I mean, right now, you know, for Burma is not in the news in the way it was at the beginning of 2021, right after the military coup. But we have continued to make progress, particularly in Congress, to make sure that Congress, you know, fully funds Burma-related programs in the State and Foreign Operations Appropriations Budget. And this may seem a little obscure, but this is vital funding that is of key support to the democracy movement in Burma. And we've also made continual progress in working with our friends in Congress to put pressure on the U.S. administration, impose further targeted sanctions on the Myanmar military, and start to cut it off from the revenue and the arms and the aviation fuel that it needs to stay in power. This is all stuff that we've been able to do without major coverage of Burma in the media. And that's because we organize. That's because we continually grow our email list of people who take action every week. We send emails to our supporters two or three times a week with, this is the action that you can take now. We've got a very high response rate, very high action rate, because we're giving people timely information and a little bit of an update about what's going on in these countries when it's not in the news. That's how we, you know, continue to make a difference. That's how we continue to just kind of push the envelope further. I mean, one of the things we've done just recently is we've worked to create the first ever Congressional Burma Caucus. It's a bipartisan caucus of House members, and it's another way in which we're working with our friends and champions in Congress to affect further changes in policy by the U.S. administration. And again, we've done all that without Burma really being in the news, because we've been able to build up our support, you know, every week, every month, through this kind of organizing.
Simon, we're running out of our time, unfortunately. If listeners are inspired and want to join global efforts to end genocide, ethnic cleansing, war, environmental destruction, what are some of the first steps they can take?
Well, I highly recommend that people go to our website, nobusinesswithgenocide.org, and you'll find right on there actions you can take. Gives you the ability to get on our email list and get further updates periodically about how you can take action. Also recommend Genocide Watch as a very good all-purpose resource on genocide and other mass atrocities around the world.
Simon Billiness, this has been an incredible discussion. We really are in awe of your work. We hope to stay in touch with you, and thank you for everything you're doing to hold corporations accountable.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well. Thank you.
nuclear holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh, yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3.
Teachers shape the future. Right now, in a classroom somewhere in the United States, there's a teacher inspiring a future scientist who'll make preventing pandemics their life's work. Sharpening the mind of an aspiring environmentalist who'll help combat climate change and generating possibilities for a student who'll be the first in their family to graduate college. Explore a career that leaves a legacy you can be proud of. Teach. Learn more and receive free support at teach.org.
Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers.